It turns out life is everywhere. From glaciers to permafrost, strange species survive conditions even in the dark, well below freezing. Now microbial life in the ice world is changing Earth's climate as climate changes them. A team of scientists reviewed what is known. They just published the paper, Current and Projected Effects of Climate Change in Cryosphere Microbial Ecosystems. The lead author is Scott Sugden, a research scientist and lecturer at McGill University in Montreal. He joins us now. Scott Sugden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Was there a particular question that drove you and your colleagues to assess life in the coldest places?
You know, like you just mentioned, Earth has many cold temperature ecosystems, permafrost, glaciers, sea ice, and all of these ecosystems are really sensitive to warming. And so, you know, we kind of set out to ask this question, well, across all of these ecosystems, what are some of the general consistent truths that we see in terms of microbial responses to warming? And then where is there nuance? You know, where do we need to put an asterisk next to that truth and say, well, this is true most of the time, but in a few cases it might be a little different.
Well, these little creatures that we cannot see colonize some seemingly impossible environments. Tell us about surprising places in the catalog of cold, hardy life.
It's truly amazing where these microorganisms are able to live and metabolize, you know, inside glacial ice. Frozen environment, you know, you'd think there's a lot of water there because it's ice, but you know, most of that water is frozen, so it's not available for a cell to use. Similarly, in permafrost, so soil that's, you know, deep underground and frozen all year long, microorganisms are able to find these really, really thin veins of water that provide just enough to survive. There are ecosystems in the Arctic, in some of the places that we work, some springs that discharge water from deep underground. This water is significantly saltier than seawater, minus 5 degrees Celsius most of the time, and still microorganisms are able to live there.
What are the lowest temperatures where living things have been found, and how do they survive down there?
So lowest temperature that they've been found is tricky because microorganisms can often live or survive at lower temperatures than they're active. They can just go into kind of periods of dormancy. The same way an animal might hibernate through the winter, if it just gets a little bit too cold, a microorganism will shut down and wait for the right time. But microbial activity has been detected as low as minus 20, minus 25 degrees Celsius, active microbial activity. And a lot of what they do is they find these really thin veins of water that contain higher concentrations of salt. So high salt concentrations in water lowers the freezing point. And so even at, you know, minus 7, minus 8 degrees, if the water is salty enough or contains enough solutes, you'll have this thin vein of water that's preserved that allows these cells to live.
Scott, are there viruses in this frozen world? And what about the stories of ancient organisms that could cause disease emerging from long frozen stores?
There are viruses in these ecosystems. These viruses serve more of an ecological role. They're kind of the predators of the bacteria that live in these ecosystems. So we're not talking about viruses that, you know, might infect humans or cause human health issues. These are kind of important aspects of any microbial community.
Why do you say, quote, the trajectory of our warming world will be closely linked to microbial activity within the warming cryosphere?
That's a wonderful question, and it's one that has and continues to fascinate me. You know, all of these microorganisms that live in these really cold temperature environments, for the longest time, they've been really strongly limited by kind of two major things. One, they don't have a lot of food that they can use for their metabolism. Or in the cases where there might be a lot of food available, that food is frozen, so they can't actually use it. So limitation number one, not much food. And then number two, these cold temperatures have really slowed down their metabolisms. It's the same as, you know, humans when we get hypothermic, our metabolisms will slow down. At low temperatures, these bacterial metabolisms slow down. And that's been the truth for the past, you know, several hundred years. But now, with climate change, both of those limitations are going away. As these ecosystems thaw, more food becomes available. And that's not just temperature driven, but more precipitation, more runoff will move nutrients around, make more food available. And then warming temperatures are accelerating these metabolisms. And so both of those things, when you think about them happening across a landscape as vast as the cryosphere, think of how much of the world is covered by permafrost, sea ice, glaciers. Think Antarctica in there as well, the Greenland ice sheet. Even small upticks in microbial activity over such a large area are going to start to have some really profound consequences.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex returns with Dr. Scott Sigerton on the hidden microbial life in the ice world.
The Antarctic ice sheet alone covers about 8.3% of Earth's land surface. Were you able to find out much about the microbes living there, or is that still largely unknown?
Deep within Antarctica is still more largely unknown. There are some places in Antarctica that have attracted particular research attention. For example, there's a place in Antarctica called the Dry Valleys, which, as their name implies, are one of the driest environments on Earth. But I hesitate to generalize findings from a few places across the continent as big as Antarctica.
One thing we learned from talking with microbiologist David Thaler at the University of Basel, there is no catalog of all the microlife on Earth, and that can actually never be constructed because they evolve so quickly that new living things tend to show up in every sample, he told us. Does that sound like we only know a fraction of what is alive in the cryosphere?
I would agree. It's one of the challenges with cataloging microbial species in that way is, like this previous guest has mentioned, that there are so many species and they change so rapidly. But in terms of when we're thinking about their influences on the climate and other aspects of ecosystem function, even though microbial species and their identities might vary and change a lot among sites or even among years, a lot of their functions, a lot of what they're doing in an ecosystem are pretty conserved or consistent, which is how we can start to study how these communities are responding to warming.
Talk to us about life in the upper layer of glaciers and ice sheets, the so-called weathering crust.
So the weathering crust is the very surface layer of a glacier, a layer that receives, you know, lots of sunlight input and provides, and therefore provides a good habitat for photosynthetic microorganisms. You can think, you know, on top of the glacier, there's a lot of sunlight coming in, especially in Arctic regions where you get 24-hour sunlight in the summer. That provides a good niche for photosynthetic microorganisms to survive.
Is there anything living deep inside the glaciers and the ice sheets?
That's a trickier question for us as scientists, because to study microbial life deep within a glacier, we need to be able to drill down and collect ice deep within the glacier. And that, you know, continues to be a pretty strong logistical challenge. There's some limited evidence that microorganisms do survive in these deeper glacial environments, that they are still active there. But something is still really tough for us to measure.
So about a quarter to a half of organic carbon stored on land on this planet is in the cryosphere, we're told, held there like a cold locker. What did your study find about the impacts of extra warming in the Arctic when it comes to microbes releasing this carbon to the atmosphere?
So like I mentioned earlier, you know, for the longest time, this carbon has been locked away, frozen, not available for microorganisms to use, and even the little bits that were available, microbial metabolisms have been really slow because of the cold temperatures. With a little bit of warming, we start to see that a lot of these resources, these food resources, carbon stores, become available for microorganisms to use, and their metabolisms start to accelerate. And where this becomes challenging is, so accelerated metabolism, microorganisms eat these foods, this organic material that's been locked away in that carbon locker, And they respire it. So what that means is they send carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as a result of their metabolism. And more carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, of course, not a good thing in the context of climate change. The other side to that story, though, is that photosynthetic metabolisms, metabolisms that take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, back into the soil or the ice, also accelerate. And so, and a good thing for climate change. But what we see is that respiration, that process of sending carbon to the atmosphere, accelerates more quickly than photosynthesis, that process of bringing carbon back. And so as these ecosystems are starting to warm, they're starting to send more and more carbon into the atmosphere than they're taking out.
We picture a very rich trove of nutrients becoming available in thawing permafrost. Are there any signs of limits, like some missing nutrients or gases that could stall a wave of new microbial life near the warming poles?
So right now, a lot of these microorganisms are limited because they don't have enough nitrogen or phosphorus. That has been a significant kind of constraint on their activity. And in ecosystems that don't have much nitrogen or phosphorus, we see these warming effects are dampened a bit because the microorganisms still don't have enough for their metabolism. But when there's nitrogen and phosphorus around, microorganisms are pretty happy to start using it once they've warmed up.
There are kind of two parts to climate impacts we're talking here. I mean, change is happening now or expected in the next decade or two, and then there's the long-term play of new ecosystems developing. Has climate change already impacted microbe life in ways scientists can document now?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that we're seeing with warming environments is changes in a lot of these cryosphere habitats. You imagine, you know, what has been a glacier and a glacial microbial community, with warming, that glacier melts, it retreats, and we lose that glacial microbial ecosystem, and it becomes replaced with kind of a soil microbial ecosystem that takes over that space where the glacier was. And so those are things that lots of researchers are starting to study, this process of community change. What's challenging for us is that the understanding of microorganisms in these environments and the study of these microorganisms really only started about 15 to 20 years ago. And so unlike plant and animal ecology, where species have been documented and studied for quite some time, and you can look back at, you know, a 100-year historical record to see how things have changed, we don't have that long history of microbial understanding. So in many ways, we're seeing these changes as they're happening and don't necessarily have that baseline reference.
In another climate-related factor, you find that even the change of activity in microbes in the polar regions could change the albedo, the reflection of solar light back into space. How does that work?
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier the weathering crust, this layer on the top of a glacier. And I mentioned that there's a lot of photosynthetic microorganisms that live there. Photosynthetic microorganisms have a little pigment or a little bit of color to them. That's what helps them absorb the energy from the sunlight. And so if we start to get more and more of these photosynthetic microbes, you can think of this kind of big algae bloom on a glacial surface that reduces or that pigments the glacial surface a little bit. So instead of this, you know, nice white snow or ice, you get slightly pigmented, slightly purplish or pinkish or greenish coloration. And that color absorbs more solar energy and causes the ice and snow to melt faster.
Is it fair to say that the warm-up of cold living spaces creates multiple climate feedbacks and some slow warming, but generally it's going to lead to more warming?
That's the conclusion that we're reaching right now, is that in general, this warming of the cryosphere is going to increase microbial activity in ways that promote further warming. And there's a lot of nuance to that. You know, like we've talked about, well, how much nitrogen and phosphorus there is. These nitrogen and phosphorus-rich ecosystems are probably going to contribute more. More limited ecosystems will contribute less. We also see variation based on how much oxygen is available. So some habitats, when they thaw, they go underwater, they become really wet. And so there's not a lot of oxygen available for use. Or some regions dry out. And so that increases the amount of oxygen that organisms can use. And those things can influence kind of the rate and magnitude of climate effects that these ecosystems have.
I'm curious, how was this review done? Did you survey a bunch of articles or use machine learning? What did you do to produce this?
I have not yet gotten on the machine learning bandwagon. So this was a lot of just a literature survey. Again, with this question, we wanted to identify general truths across the breadth of cryosphere ecosystems. So we wanted to make sure we were seeing what people were discovering in sea ice, in permafrost, in glaciers, in snow, in tundra soils, to really distill, well, you know, here are the things that we know that are consistent, and here are the things that are more context-dependent.
As your review points out, a lot of papers are based on results from a few field trips to select locations, and most of those studies are in summer just for logistical and human survival reasons. If I were a multi-billionaire and I authorize $1 billion for research on climate changes to life in the cryosphere, Scott, what kinds of research would you recommend to fill in the gaps in our knowledge?
That is a challenging question. There is a lot of things that we don't know. And like you highlighted, so far, nations and governmental organizations have done a really great job of funding and supporting cryosphere research that brings us to the same places every time. I think if I could take that $1 billion, what I want to do is I'd want to get a really geographically distributed set of samples. You know, I'd want ice from all the major areas that are covered by ice. I'd want permafrost from all the major areas that have permafrost so that we can get an understanding of what some of these baseline qualities are. You know, how much, we don't always know how much nitrogen or phosphorus is in some different ecosystems just because we haven't been there to measure it. We don't always know what the permafrost temperature is in some different ecosystems just because we haven't always been there to measure it. So we know how microorganisms respond to temperature generally and to moisture generally and to nutrients generally. And so if we can get better resolution on, well, you know, what is the moisture and nutrient content across the cryosphere, that would be really helpful.
So after all of this work, Scott, what is your greatest concern? Is this just a story of life morphing into new ecosystems, or could a rapid change in microbial worlds change things for us as humans?
I think it's important to recognize that these changes in cryosphere microbial ecosystems, although we talk about them mostly with respect to their effects on the climate, which certainly affects us, these consequences can also have all sorts of other cascading effects on human ecosystems. You know, increasing microbial metabolisms can produce contaminants, and then precipitation and runoff will wash those contaminants into the ocean, where they end up in the food supply. And so it can affect food and income security for indigenous people and people who rely on marine resources. Similarly, you brought up albedo reduction. We're seeing these changes affect the melt and timing of ice. And so although we talk about climate, I think it's important to recognize that these changes affect more than just the climate. They're affecting all sorts of things that we as humans are going to start experiencing if we haven't already.
I think that's a great point, but I would like to say, too, that what we haven't talked about here is methane production, and that's a big concern for many of our listeners, that permafrost thaw or other changes in the Arctic will release a lot of methane. What do you think?
Yeah, so earlier I mentioned how the availability of oxygen in an ecosystem can really influence the outcomes of these accelerated microbial processes. Permafrost, when it thaws, in many cases can become anaerobic. There's not a lot of oxygen for microorganisms to use. And when microorganisms lack oxygen, one of the things that they'll do with their food or their carbon supply is produce methane. But on the other hand, if we have ecosystems that dry out more, that become more aerobic, lots of those microorganisms will eat methane and they'll release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere instead. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so back to your question of, you know, what would I do with $1 billion? The reason we're concerned about permafrost and methane is because a lot of these habitats become anaerobic and therefore become methane sources. But there are a lot of these permafrost habitats that we just don't know whether they're skewing towards an anaerobic or an aerobic lifestyle. And so it's hard to really understand and quantify, well, how much methane is going to come out of there.
What are you working on now?
So my lab's research, I personally have been doing a lot of work looking at the transition from glacial ice communities to post-glacial soil communities. That transition I mentioned earlier, you know, as glaciers recede, we're seeing a huge community change, and that has cascading influences on microbial function. Our lab has also done some work with permafrost. There's a site that we've been to over many years, and so we're looking at kind of changes in microbial metabolisms over about 15 years of permafrost thaw.
From McGill University, we've been speaking with researcher Scott Sugden. He led a review study titled Current and Projected Effects of Climate Change in Cryosphere Microbial Ecosystems. It is a window to some of these far-out worlds, and you can find a link and notes about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Scott, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. That sounds great. And once again, I want to emphasize, I really appreciate what you do to help bring research to the general public. I think this is, you know, really important messages that sometimes get lost in our little echo world of publications.
Radio EcoShock.